May it please the court, Maurice Baskin for the plaintiff employer appellants. We're here challenging an unprecedented expansion of rulemaking authority by the National Labor Relations Board.
Is it more expansive than the last one?
Yes. I don't know if we can quite match the interest in that, but in fact, this one affects 6 million employers around the country. This is the first time in the history of the Act that the board has attempted to impose an affirmative obligation on these employers who have done nothing wrong to communicate with their employees the message of unionism, which is what is involved in this particular notice. This is a Chevron Step 1 case, somewhat different analysis from the previous case. What we need here, the rule must be set aside unless the board can show that Congress has expressly or implicitly delegated authority to it. And it should be mentioned right off the bat, the district court got it backwards, and so does the board. They're saying that unless we can show that authority of the board was prohibited by the statute, that they win somehow. But that's not what this court has said in a long line of cases going back to the Railway Labor Executives case, which the district court largely ignored. But the Act is not silent. In fact, the Act has language, structure, and history that all unambiguously indicate that Congress did not want the board to have the authority to require employers to make these general notice postings to their employees. And let me just mention a few that are cited in more detail in the brief, but let's begin with Section 10A, conveniently titled Powers of the Board. And it says, the board is empowered as hereinafter provided to prevent any person from engaging in any unfair labor practice listed in Section 8, as hereinafter provided, not as provided in Section 6 or some other place. And what is hereinafter provided? The complaint procedure, complaints that can only be brought by private parties, not the board acting as a roving commission. The board does not even contest that it lacks the authority to act as a roving commission, unlike many other agencies.
Now, that's what Judge Norton basically ruled. And can I just interrupt you and ask, where is that in the Fourth Circuit? Is this being argued before it? Or?
Yes, their briefing schedule is well behind. They've not yet filed the first briefs. Okay. So there'll be a while before they get there. And so we begin with, again, the language which we agree with Judge Norton's decision. Should be mentioned that both of the district courts here found some aspects of the rule to be unambiguously prohibited by the Act and inconsistent without delegation of authority by the Act. So both judges were in partial agreement. We agree with Judge Norton that the entire rule is invalid because of the lack of authority and because of the specific language beginning with 10A, but then look at Section 8A1. It says it's limited to acts of interference with employee rights. The employers who are covered by this new rule have done nothing to interfere with the rights of their employees. And then most of all, Section 8C is the most explicit statement in the Act on this very issue, because it says that expressing of any views shall not constitute or be evidence of an unfair labor practice, constitute or be evidence, which means it can't be an unfair labor practice and it can't be used as some sort of finding of anti-union animus in other unfair labor practice proceedings, so long as it's not coercive. This section is unique to the National Labor Relations Act. The Supreme Court in Chamber versus Brown said that 8C is an explicit direction by Congress to leave non-coercive speech unregulated. And yet, what do we have here? We have the board issuing a regulation contrary to the explicit language of the statute, which, in fact, is regulating the communication by employers by forcing them to communicate with their employees and doing so in a completely one-sided fashion. For evidence of this, all you need to do is plug in the word bias in the conveniently digitized rulemaking, and you will come up with thousands of hits in which employers have protested. There's been a firestorm of protest about this rule ever since it was published. Some 7,000 comments were filed, complaining really on two bases. Why we're here today, grassroots, really, frankly, members of a broad cross-section of the business community, saying, first of all, what business is it of the board to come into our workplace and do this when the statute for 77 years has indicated that they will not do it and will instead be only a reactive agency? And then they've done it in an entirely one-sided fashion, essentially telling these employers to endorse this message by putting it on their bulletin boards in a manner that is explicitly directed and, according to the Supreme Court, something that they are not supposed to do. Now, the district court really just tossed aside 75 years of Supreme Court authority that we put into our briefs to her as well as to you, because she said, well, those are limited to adjudications. Chamber of Commerce versus Brown actually did not arise in an adjudication of that type, but there's nothing, no court has previously held that the rulemaking authority of Section 6, whatever it may mean, gives the board greater authority, untethered by any of the Supreme Court rulings about the limits.
The board never, hardly ever used its rulemaking authority. That was one of, in fact, it was one of the complaints about the board's using adjudication, which is necessarily a method of making a rule that applies nationwide, but without the participation of all the people who were affected. And the Bell Aerospace case is one example where the Supreme Court said that they have the discretion whether to proceed by rulemaking,
yes,
cover everybody.
Yes, and let me be clear. We are not saying that the board can only act by adjudication. Just, I was about to say, Bell Aerospace, the board, that court has said it's up to the board which way to proceed. And we're not saying that they can't issue general rules, substantive versus procedure. The other side has apparently misconceived their argument on that score. All we're saying is that the same level of authority applies. If the board doesn't have the authority, doesn't have the power to impose affirmative obligations on employers that are not remedying actual violations of the act, if they can't do it through adjudications, which they clearly cannot, then they cannot do it through rulemaking, or else we're going to have to relitigate 75 years of Supreme Court doctrine, and the board will have limitless authority, which is what this court has said in numerous places should not be allowed. And the general...
What was the... I've forgotten what the issue was in Bell Aerospace, or what it was that the board was imposing.
Well, managerial employees.
Managerial employees. Well, can the board, through a regulation, cover, say, okay, from here on out, all nurses are covered?
If they can show, if it's a regulation that is in aid of Section 9, which is what happened in the Hospital Association case, or Section 8, something that they have done through adjudication, then they would be at their strongest.
See, the lower court judge in that case, Henry Friendly, said that the board had to proceed by regulation, had to, and that's what the Supreme Court reversed. But
right.
But I don't want to get too far ahead of you in your argument, but the one of the sections you haven't mentioned is Section 7. Now, under Supreme Court precedent, when it says necessary to implement the provisions of this act, the Supreme Court has interpreted that boilerplate language, which is in many, many regulatory statutes, as saying that if it's a reasonable implementation of the purposes of the act, then the regulation is authorized under, and Section 7 says, protects the right of employees to join, organize, bargain collectively. So why isn't this consistent with a line of Supreme Court cases going back to Thorpe and Morning versus Family Publication Service and so on?
Well, as we pointed out in the brief, they run squarely into your opinion, frankly, in the Colorado River case, which says that you don't take the general aspirational provisions of an act and find through rulemaking that without considering the means designated by Congress to meet those provisions. And beyond that, here we have the explicit statements that they are limited in what they are supposed to be able to do. So Colorado River really answers the question, and in particular about the Morning case, Morning, which was decided before Chevron, in Colorado River, as well as in Ragsdale. The court, the Supreme Court itself said that you can't take Morning as license to just have a limitless authority by any agency to engage in a rulemaking beyond the level of power where they have not been delegated the authority for that specific rule. It really doesn't answer the question. In fact, I think that's the way you put it in Colorado River, where the court put it. It does not answer the question of the specific rule. Just because there is a general aspirational purpose of the act, that doesn't say how the board is supposed to go about achieving that purposes. And it's why you can't ignore the very detailed structure and language of this act, all of which are designed to make the board a reactive agency to wait for actual violations and then remedy them, and even when a violation has occurred, not to issue a remedy that goes beyond the scope of that particular violation, because that's the message of every one of the Supreme Court cases that we've cited. And instead, what the board has done here is it's created its own violation and then said, okay, well, now we'll use the Section 10 procedures to administer that. But that is something that is not permitted by Section 8, it's not permitted by Section 10, and it's in particular not permitted by Section 8C. And we haven't yet talked about the legislative history, which, if there was any doubt about the question, is conclusively in our favor. The board cites no legislative history to support the notion that Congress intended the board to have the power to issue rules that would require a notice from employers who have not violated the act and when you don't have representation. But in fact, Congress has put this notice posting requirement in virtually every other labor statute before, during, and after the passage of the act. The Railway Labor Act discussion of adding the notice requirement was going on parallel to discussion by the same congressman. There's an excellent chart in the congressional amicus brief showing this, literally week by week. They're talking about adding notice to the Railway Labor Act. They're talking about deleting notice provision from the National Labor Relations Act. Then they pass the act, and in virtually every statute thereafter, they put a notice provision right in the statute, all the while not adding it to the National Labor Relations Act. When they do amend the act, what do they do in 1947? They add 8C, which simply says to Congress, hands off employer communications. And that is conclusive that there is no authority on the part of the board. There's no delegation of authority. It is not a question of a silent act, although if it were, we would still win, and the board would still be, the board order should still be set aside. I'd like to reserve the remaining time for rebuttal, although we could certainly talk about Chevron Step 2 or severability questions, but really, I stop here now because there is no reason for you to go beyond Chevron Step 1.
In a representation election, the employer is responsible for posting, isn't it?
Yes.
He hasn't committed an unfair labor practice.
No, but that's what I've said. There are two possibilities under Section 9. That's the statutory authorization. No, and not only that, it doesn't violate 8C because they're not being accused of committing an unfair labor practice. They're not being found in violation there. They're simply being told to post a notice that is in aid of the representation process.
What is your answer to the board's point and the district court's too, that this is just this is government speech? It's not a message from the employer. And I take it that if you didn't like what the board is saying or you don't think it's complete, that you could put your own employer message right next to it.
This is not government speech. This is government compelled speech. That's the big difference. There is obvious confusion in the minds of employees who see something on the employer's bulletin board that says, here are all the ways to complain and to go get unionized, that this is a message coming from the employers. That's certainly what the employers themselves see it as when they are being told to do this. This is certainly falls within the Woolley doctrine, which what could be more a government than a license plate? But the Supreme Court said that it was something that was not permitted for the government to force the employers to communicate the government, the message that the government wanted them to. And with 8C, there's no exception in 8C for government speech, so it's not even an issue. 8C simply says expression of views cannot be made the subject of an unfair labor practice. So for that reason as well, the government speech idea goes nowhere.
There's one other question I have before you you sit down. You mentioned, I think in several places, one place I've marked is page 15, that the regulatory notice is slanted toward unionization. And one of the reasons is it doesn't inform the employees of their BEC rights, okay? First of all, the only situation in which BEC rights come is when there is a union already.
Yes.
And second of all, the NLRB requires the unions to inform the employees of their BEC rights. And the board said, we don't see any evidence that unions aren't doing that. So
When the unions have taken an action, and here the employers have not done anything. That's the huge difference in the BEC situation. There's a notice requirement when something has been done to those employees, namely money is being taken from them. And in order to remedy that issue, that's why BEC right notices come about. But here, there's something else that's not been put forward by the board. There's no substantial evidence that this rule, that this notice will accomplish anything. It's all this talk about lack of awareness of by employees of their rights. The court recently in the Reynolds case said putting out this kind of requirement, any kind of requirement, imposing it on people without any evidence, without any empirical study to show that it actually will accomplish the government's supposed interests, defeats the claim by the government. And we submit for that reason as well that this particular rule should be set aside. Thank you.
Ms. Goldstein.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Dawn Goldstein. I'm here representing the National Labor Relations Board in this case. The rule being challenged in this case establishes a duty for all employers already within the board's jurisdiction to post an official board notice informing employees of their rights under the Act. This rule corrects a long-standing anomaly. Until now, the board has been almost alone among agencies and departments administering major federal labor and employment laws and not requiring employers to routinely post workplace notices. This prevailing practice reflects a common understanding that such notices are a minimal necessity to ensure that employees are informed of their workplace rights. In NLRB versus Weingarten, the Supreme Court explained, the responsibility to adapt the Act to the changing patterns of industrial life is entrusted to the board. Here, the board did precisely that by taking careful account of declining union density, rising rates of immigration, and the absence of any other general requirement that employees be informed of their NLRA rights.
Did you say adjusting to the changing what?
Conditions.
What has changed?
Your Honor, the rule explains that because union density has gone down dramatically and because that leaves less of a source of information about union rights available to employees, as well as high number of immigrants in the workforce who may not know anything about American worker rights laws, that those conditions have created a state of ignorance of NLRA rights among the general population and even among...
What was the percentage of employers who were unionized when the National Labor Relations Act was passed?
Your Honor, I don't know that information. It's not in the record. But let me just state here that the employers waived this point in the first footnote of their opening brief. They said, we are waiving our challenge that this rule is arbitrary and capricious. This is something that was litigated at the district court level, and they've waived it here because the evidence is so clear from the record that there were many, many comments from employees saying that they don't know what their rights are.
What's the theory if there is a union already? Why is it that the employer is the one that has to inform the employees of their rights? Why isn't it the union that should have the responsibility?
Your Honor, this rule is structured just like all the other workplace notice laws and regulations, that it's the employer's duty to put it in a common work area like a coffee break room or a copy room where employees come, where they can learn about the rights that they need to know about as they're in the workplace.
But why, and the union has no responsibility?
Your Honor, but the as we've stated, union density has gone way down. At this point, I believe it's somewhere around 7% of the private sector workforce. So even if unions were telling those employees, that still leaves 93% of the American private sector workforce that isn't being told about their NLRA rights. And as we stated in our brief, there is a huge amount of evidence that even attorneys don't understand, who don't practice in this area, don't understand that non-union employees still have NLRA rights. The Nancy King article that we cited is just the tip of the iceberg on that front.
You have a website, I take.
We have a website, but Your Honor, we're allowed to try to communicate that message out. But if employees have no idea that these rights even apply to them, they wouldn't know to go to our website. So it's there's trillions of websites, and we can't hope that they're going to find us. We think employers should have the obligation to put up the notice so that employees do have notice, and then can go to our website to find out more information as the notice explains to them.
Mm-hmm. I can understand why this would be useful to do, maybe even helpful to do, but how is it necessary?
Your Honor, necessary has been construed for decades. It appears in many general rulemaking provisions, and it's always been construed in a very broad manner. In the Thorpe and Mourning cases that Judge Randolph brought up, it's been construed to mean that it's as long as it furthers the purposes of the Enabling Act, that is considered necessary. And as we explain, this rule actually carries out not only Section 7, because employees can't fully and freely exercise their rights unless they know these rights exist. But we explained in the rule that it carries out 8, 9, and 10. And we explained it's precisely because we are not self-initiating and we are not a roving commission that employee knowledge of our act is crucial. Because if they don't know that there's a 6-month statute of limitation, they could very well sleep on their rights and lose their rights. So the only way to effectuate national labor policy of correcting unfair labor practices and having representation petitions is by making sure employees understand the processes in 8, 9, and 10. So there's this critical link between employees' timely awareness of their NLRA rights and the fulfillment of the Act's objectives. So for that reason, Your Honor, Mr. Baskin explained that if this rule could not be done in adjudication, then it couldn't be done in rulemaking. We take very much issue with that. We don't see why this rule couldn't have been done in an adjudication.
So, I'm trying to think how that would happen. You have a workplace and it's not unionized, and an employee calls up the general counsel and says, look, there's an unfair labor practice going on here continuously because this fellow who owns this company has not posted a notice informing me of everything that the National Labor Relations Act does. So you think that in that situation the general counsel could bring an action and get a unfair labor practice charge upheld?
We think that a charge could be brought stating that employees are...
Oh, it could be brought, yeah. You can bring
right.
anything.
But
yeah.
We also think the general counsel could theoretically issue complaint if the general counsel found that the lack of knowledge was...
Yeah, you could issue a complaint, but I'm not asking that question. I'm asking the question whether the board would be upheld finding an unfair labor practice in that situation.
Your Honor, we very much believe that we would. We believe that interfere has been construed broadly enough to include... The employer's failure to post a notice that is essential to employees.
You're telling us that 6 million employers in the United States are, at this very moment, committing unfair labor practice.
We don't have a charge right now, but we think that should this rule go into effect and then they fail to post and the rule envisions that regional directors will...
This is something the board has just recently discovered, that all these unfair labor practices are going on.
Your Honor, I'm not sure. Can you rephrase the question, please?
It's just a recent discovery by the board.
It
hasn't been going on since the passage of the National Labor Relations Act. At some point, they all fell into noncompliance, right?
Well, Your Honor, we think that there's been a slow decline over time. Obviously, union density has greatly decreased since the 1960s, and over that time, there is greater and greater lack of knowledge. We received comments that are in the record explaining and that are in the preamble from employers saying you shouldn't have this rule because employees don't have a right to unionize. And there were numerous comments like that. So it's those kind of comments which only illustrated our point that there was a need for this rule. But as I said, this is something that the employers have already conceded.
Are you saying that even without this rule, this failure to notify would be an unfair labor practice?
Well, what I'm saying is that the board could consider a complaint that alleged that the failure to have a notice up of employee rights is an unfair labor practice because it interferes with the exercise of employee Section 7 rights. As we explained in our brief, Judge Learned Hands eventually came around to the opinion that interference can be inaction as well as action. And we also know that 8A1 is broader than just 8A2 through 8A5. 8A1 is meant to be broad enough to enable the board to adapt the act to changing industrial circumstances. And we cited the technology services case where if an employer fails to disclose needed information to the union, that failure of action can be an unfair labor practice.
Well, what possible limit then is there to the board's authority? So any failure to inform, if the employer has a lot of employees who are immigrants and they haven't done this in all the various languages, is that a potential unfair labor practice?
Well, Your Honor, it's in the final rule. A bright line was, that's why the rulemaking process was a much better process for this than an adjudication would have been, because in the rule we were able to solicit information about that, and the board came up with a rule that if 20% or more of the workforce speaks a different language, you need to have a poster in that language, which the board provides for free. So because the board went through this rulemaking process, they were able to solicit this information and gather it in a way that isn't as possible in an adjudication, just like Judge Friendly urged. But to go back to your question about being limitless, the limits are clearly set out in Warning. You have to be within, you have to be furthering the purposes of your act. And of course, you cannot be in conflict with the text of your act. Let me contrast this situation with the Colorado River case that Mr. Baskin brought up. Colorado River was a case where the statute laid out two different regulatory schemes for two different kinds of Indian gaming. Class 2 was set up to be regulated by the National Gaming Commission. Class 3, it was set out that it had to be done through state and tribal compacts. Then when the Federal Commission tried to regulate Class 3 gaming, that's a conflict. But here, there is nothing in our statute remotely like that. Yes, we have adjudicative provisions, and yes, we have rulemaking provisions. There are lots of agencies that have rulemaking and adjudicative provisions, and these are not mutually exclusive. As the Trans-Pacific Freight case that we cited, it explains that you're not supposed to use the formalities of the adjudicative process to constrict unnecessarily the rulemaking process unless there's a clear congressional intent to do that. And there is no intent.
But if you don't have to focus on a nexus between the specific duties of the board, then the board arguably can make rules just about industrial policy generally within the United States. And it's, what I would like to know is, what's the limiting principle here?
Your Honor, respectfully, that's not true. If we were to only have a rule that only tried to further a goal that's only in Section 1, we can't do that under the Colorado River decision. But if we have a rule that furthers 7, 8, 9, 10, that's exactly what general rulemaking authority contemplates. And this rule, as we've shown, it furthers all of those provisions to make the act work as Congress intended it to.
What enforcement authority does the board have other than declaring an unfair labor practice and then seeking judicial enforcement?
That is the only remedial authority. So if this rule were to go into effect, as we hope it does, and should an employer choose not to post the notice, the only thing that's going to happen is that there could be an unfair labor practice charge. The employer would be contacted by the regional office. They'll be asked to put it up. And if they don't put it up, then there would be our normal adjudicative processes. But their complaint that somehow this is outside of the board's jurisdiction, frankly, just doesn't make sense.
So there's no other way other than getting judicial enforcement on after an unfair labor practice charge? That's the only way. Is that true of the Railway Labor Act, too?
Are you referring, sir, to the Railway Labor Executives case or the Act in general?
No, the Act.
I'm not familiar with the Railway Labor Act in total. Do you want me to speak to the differences between those two cases? Because that case has been brought up. The Railway Labor Executives case is in no way like this one. The National Mediation Board has no general rulemaking authority, and what they were doing was in conflict with their act. The act does say that only parties to the representation proceeding can request that the NMB begin its processes. And then the NMB went ahead and said that no, carriers and the board itself could initiate those processes. That's a clear conflict with the statute. Plus, there was a lot of conflicting legislative history. We don't have any conflicting statutory language, and we don't have any conflicting legislative history.
What do you do? What's your answer to the argument that the petitioners raise that the notice is one-sided, that it violates 8C in the First Amendment because it's viewpoint discriminatory? And there's Supreme Court cases that say that even though a particular speech item would not be, it could be regulated by the state, for example, obscenity, what the state can't do is say outlaw obscenity that deals with the Democratic Party. I mean, they can't do the viewpoint thing, and they say this. And the leading case is RAV, an opinion by Justice Scalia.
But Your Honor, this First Amendment challenge is actually focused on whether this is government speech or not. And while the employers make a lot of noise that they're being forced to speak against their will, this notice has the NLRB seal on it. It states that it's an official government notice.
Yeah, but that doesn't immunize it from viewpoint discrimination.
Right, and it's also non.
I mean, if somehow or another you could tweak out a regulatory power to require, suppose that the government said all employers in the United States have to post a poster of President Obama who's in favor of labor unions. Now, you couldn't do that, right?
That would be ideological.
That's government speech.
Well, it would be ideological.
And say, this is a message from your government.
I mean, that would take it out of the government speech exemption, I believe, because it would be ideological. But
no, because it's viewpoint discriminatory, and they're saying that this notice that the NLRB is requiring is also viewpoint, because it's heavily weighted toward unionization.
Well, the case that they're relying on is Woolley, and Woolley.
I'm not relying on Woolley. Relying on RAV.
But we don't think that it's viewpoint discriminatory, because the act is not unbalanced. They complain about the Beck rights, and as Your Honor noted, unions are already required to give notices of Beck rights, not to mention that it applies to a very small
subset.
What
about the decertification?
Well, if you read the notice, we also don't have anything about the right to certify union. So we don't have the right to certify union. We don't have the right to decertify union. It's balanced. And in terms
No. It says you have the right to join and organize.
But it also says you have the right to not do those things. The notice is very carefully structured to be balanced. It gives examples of unfair labor practices by unions and employers. And it tells anyone who thinks that any of these things have happened to come to the board. And it also gives all of the Section 7 rights to refrain or to participate in Section 7 rights. We don't see how this notice is unbalanced in any way. I see that my time is up. But we would ask that Your Honors please to uphold Judge Jackson on her statutory authority ruling on the separate bases of Mourning and Chevron, and furthermore to reverse her injunction of the two mechanisms, which are both lawful for the reasons stated in our briefs.
So the situation now is that it's totally voluntary?
Correct.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
How much time does Mr. Bassin have? All right, why don't you take a couple minutes?
Well, first let me answer your question, Your Honor, which was incorrectly just answered. It is not strictly voluntary. There are now still in effect, even under Judge Jackson's decision, the use in a penal way of the failure to post the notice as evidence that can be used, evidence of anti-union
in an unfair labor
use in a future unfair labor practice. Plus, the judge undermined her own decision about unfair labor practice by saying, well, sometimes it perhaps could be an unfair labor practice, and sometimes it could perhaps toll the statute of limitations. It would throw us into considerable turmoil if Judge Jackson's opinion were upheld. But what's really unnerving here, breathtaking, is the claim that we really heard for the first time today, I think, that they're now not even tethered to Section 1. And in answer to your question, Judge Brown, there are no limits if this is upheld. I mean, what's next? Is it going to be annual reports from employers? Nothing in the Act about that. Yeah, I guess that means the board says that they can require it. Training classes on how to complain and file complaints against employers, union access to conduct the training classes. Where can the board be stopped? And it is simply unimaginable. She said that they could somehow fine 6 million employers even today as committing an unfair labor practice. Unimaginable that this could have occurred in an adjudication. Just imagine it. An employer comes in completely innocent. The complaint somehow gets filed. The board dismisses the case. Every Supreme Court holding says that there is no right of the board to impose a remedy at that point. Therefore, there is no right of the board to impose anything that would look like this rule under 75 years of Supreme Court authority, and we say they don't have the right to do it through the rulemaking process. So I just, and then lastly, I want to clarify, did not bring forward the abusive, arbitrary and capricious argument, but we did not waive the notion, and they are still required to show that this is necessary. And that's what my discussion earlier was about, the fact that in the age of the Internet, when employees are flooded with information, that somehow the percentage of unionization and posting a notice on a bulletin board is necessary to achieve the apparent or claimed objectives of the board, it's ludicrous. In fact, if you go on the Internet after, just plug in employee rights, complaint, workplace, any of those, you will be flooded with information. The board gave no legitimate consideration. They gave lip service to it. They conducted no studies as to whether Internet methods would work, the board's own website. They're out there promulgating the same information. No showing that the bulletin board approach is necessary to accomplish the purposes of the Act. So for that reason as well, this whole thing fails, as Judge Norton held, and we ask that it be
before you
set aside.
Down, yes. On page 15 of your brief, I think I referred to that, the portion of the Beck, you say that it was that the notices that weighted toward unionization, and you give Beck rights, and then you give the failure to inform employees they can decertify. But you say also, among other things, what are the other things that it?
Well, in every, you have to go through word by word. If you look at the rulemaking itself, they go through every line of the rule was challenged by protesters, people filing comments. And the board was deflecting, why did it change from the actual language of the statute in almost every line. It gives six, and here's another one. It goes through six different bullet points before it reaches the one about how to unionize. And then it says, by the way, you can refrain from those things. And even there, it says, but you could join or not join the union. So even the one about refraining is tilted somehow to come out in a pro-union way. So I would refer the court to the record itself, which is quite extensive on the issue of bias and one-sidedness. Just type in the word bias. You'll be flooded with information about how one-sided this particular notice is perceived to be, and with nothing accomplished for it except to exceed the board's authority and impose new burdens on employers. Thank you.
Judge Randolph's last question to me when I said it was voluntary in the sense that the rule is not in effect right now. If it were to be in effect, even under Judge Jackson's ruling, the animus mechanism would still be in effect to enforce the rule.
I got it. Thanks.